You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk turned traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
This podcast is being brought to you by Voyage AC. Hey, what is this?
Aren't they beautiful? That's Voyage AC's new packaging, the gorgeous biophotonic glass. This is the hand sanitizer.
Wow, that smells amazing. And you know, I love to say biophotonic.
Yes, you do. And it's all organic, kills 99% of germs while leaving your face and hands feeling fresh. Voyage AC is your destination for the perfect gift or maybe just a little treat for yourself. So many gorgeous candles and other wonderful gifts like beachwear, diffusers, glamorous masks, face and body products. So how can our listeners find Voyage AC?
You can find everything on their website at www.voyageac.com. That's VoyageEtcie.com.
And as you know, Melanie is willing to give my friends and family discount to all our listeners right now. That's right, honey. That's 10% off everything you buy.
Right. And all you need to do is enter the only one at checkout.
That's right. All you have to do is enter the only one when you make your purchase. Voyage AC is an olfactory journey of candles, perfume, and organic beauty products.
This episode is being sponsored by Cute Booty Lounge.
So, do you know what season it is?
Well, it's spring, right? Because the summer solstice isn't until June 21st.
No, I mean, it's tanning season, hun. And to show off mine, I am living for these CBL Winter White Wonderland active cute booty shorts and leggings. Mm. Cute Booty Lounge is made right here in the USA by women and for women. The company is incredible, female and minority owned, and they have these super cute patented scrunch butt pockets. There is a cute booty style for everyone. Cute Booty Lounge has you covered. Embrace your body, love your booty.
And to make it even sweeter, head to cutebootylounge.com and enter the code THEONLYBOOTY to get 15% off your first order.
I love that so much.
Yes, head to cutebootylounge.com, enter the code THEONLYBOOTY to get 15% off of your first order.
I'm Cheo Hodari Coker, and I'm the only one translating Black culture for white people. The beauty of hip-hop, the beauty of film, is that both mediums allow you to define your reality, and they allow you to define your reality on your own terms. And when writing about both, and then eventually making both, you have this thing where you're trying to capture a reality, but then at the same time, not dilute it, not water it down, not make it a cliche or offend the history and the culture where it comes from.
What if you were like the Black kid from Stranger Things, and you grew up knowing everything about comic books and Dungeons and Dragons, but you had to drive a half hour out of town to get a haircut? Cheo Coker grew up in Storrs, Connecticut, playing with multicolored dice and reading J.R.R. Tolkien. But then after covering music while at Stanford University, he found himself right at home in another world, one that better matched with his outsides, hip-hop. So what would you do if you could speak the language of two cultures and felt perfectly comfortable in both? Would you pick a side and stay in one lane? Or would you become the only one in the room translating Black culture for white people? Hi, I'm Laura Cathcart-Robbins, and this is The Only One in the Room. In September 2018, I found myself in an all-too-familiar position. Looking around the room at the other attendees at a famed writer's retreat, I realized that I was the only Black woman in the room. When I wrote about my experience for the Huffington Post, something surprising happened. 24 hours after my piece went live, I had 568 direct messages in my inbox. These were messages from people of all races, ethnicities, creeds, and nationalities who had connected with my piece because they too had felt othered. These are the stories we want to share. This podcast is for anyone who has ever felt alone in a room full of people, which is to say that this podcast is for everyone. You're listening to The Only One in the Room, presented by Lipstick and Vinyl and executively produced by Christina Barcy. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and be sure to like and leave us a review of your thoughts on the show. And if you have an Only One in the Room story you'd like to share, you can DM us on Instagram at The Only One in the Room. Enjoy the show. So, Cheo Hadari Coker, hello, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good, too. So good to talk to you. You're just one of my favorite people ever. And before we start the interview, I wanted to ask you to let us all in on what's your favorite hip-hop song of all time. Just one.
Oh, see.
Yes.
Just once. Yeah, that's hard. It's damn near impossible.
Come on.
Can I at least have a tie?
Yeah, you can have a tie.
Okay. It would be a tie between Lords of the Underground's Chief Rocker.
Okay.
And the Notorious B.I.G.'s Unbelievable.
Yes. Right on. Yes.
But the thing about it is that there's so many songs that I love equally. And, the reason it's hard for me to say that is because I think there are about maybe 10 songs that I just believe are timeless. Mm-hmm. And that to me is what constitutes a classic.
Right.
Is a song that hits you the same way hearing it now as opposed to, you know, when it first came out. Mm-hmm. So for example, like a song like Big Daddy Kane's Ain't No Half Steppin'.
Mm-hmm.
Every time I hear that song, I have a palpable reaction to listen to that song. And then every single time he says, well, yo, it's 88 times set it straight. And I'm just really transported to the fact that I can't believe I first heard this song in 1988.
Yes.
Like when it first came out. And then at the same time, then it reminds me of just how old the song is and how old I am.
Mm-hmm.
And it just does something in terms of, you know, something being timeless and then at the same time reminding you of just how old you are.
Yeah.
And it takes me kind of out of the realm of enjoying the song. Not that I enjoy the song less, but every time I'm like, damn, I can't believe it. You know what I mean, because that's the thing, you know, that happens in hip hop is that it constantly reminds you, like rappers are always telling you who they are, what their name is, and what year it is.
Right.
Like there's so many songs that do that.
Mm-hmm. And then, over and
so
over.
Each song becomes its own kind of time capsule.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Chubb Rock does it, like, you know, on a song like Just the Two of Us. We
right.
talk about 1990 or what is it? 1990, you know.
Jump on the scene.
Yes. Yeah. With a pocket full of green and mm-hmm. treat them right. I mean, it's funny.
Yep.
It just takes you like, it's crazy because now those songs are as old as Rapper's Delight seemed to me when that first came out. Because I was younger when that song came out. But now, like, if you ask your average kid, like my kids,
yeah,
you know, that might as well be Duke Ellington. That might mm-hmm. as well be swing music.
Oh, yeah.
And it makes sense because it's that many years.
Right. Except for, like, this was the birth of a new genre, which is not. Well, but you know, you're right. It's exactly the same. It's exactly the same. And I knew you were going to say Unbelievable because it is the title of the book you co-wrote, right, with Reggie Rock Blythewood.
Reggie and I co-wrote the movie, Notorious.
Oh, the movie. Okay.
But the book I wrote.
You wrote all by yourself. Unbelievable, The Life, Death, and Afterlife?
Of the Notorious B.I.G.
Of the Notorious B.I.G., yeah. So I was banking on you saying that. I should have bet Scotty first.
I don't bet with you anymore, honey.
That's right.
Smart man.
Yeah.
I'm
all right.
Man.
Well, I am Laura Cathcart-Robbins, and this is The Only One in the Room, but I'm never the only one in this room because, as usual, my boyfriend, producer, and co-host, Scott Slaughter, who I call Hun, is here as well.
Hi, honey.
Hey, Hun. So, hon, today we are talking to my longtime friend, Cheo Hadari Coker. He is an author, a screenwriter, creator, showrunner, producer. I'm going to forget some of the many things he does, but those are some of the things that he is known for. He's the creator and former showrunner and executive producer of Marvel's Luke Cage, which we watched.
One of my favorites.
Yes, we love that. Mm-hmm. And currently has an overall television development and production deal for his banner-fighting 99th Entertainment with Amazon Studios.
That is a lot of stuff. And when I hear it run back,
yeah,
it just sounds like damn. But then at the same time, it's, you know, there's still a lot of things I need to get done and that I'm trying to do. So I always feel kind of disingenuous, like I'm just like almost trying to like build myself up like I'm James Brown or something, like right. You know, the hardest working man in showbiz, you know. and the way that they have all these different tunes, I mean, it's interesting, like hearing it like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also funny because you and I knowing each other, because I know you back when you were Laura Cathcart. So.
That's right.
And was at your wedding. So it's crazy. All those years ago.
You know? All those years ago. I was a publicist and you were writing for Vibe and the LA Times. And we'll get into that a little bit more. And honestly, I cut your bio down a lot when I introduced you, because I'm going to pepper this whole interview with items from it. So there's a lot more that I could have talked about in that introduction. But welcome. Welcome to the show. We're so glad to have you here, Cheo. Okay, so your story is really, I was writing out my notes. It's so epic and there's so much I want to cover. So just bear with me because I'm going to probably take you through a little bit faster than you might want to go, but I want to make sure we cover everything. And I actually want to start from when you were a kid, because I think it's so important to your story. And you grew up in Connecticut, is that right?
Yes, I was born in New Haven, Connecticut, but grew up in Storrs.
In Storrs, yeah. And I looked that up just to see where it was, because I wasn't familiar with it. Is it a predominantly white community?
Yes, although it's more diverse than it used to be. The University of Connecticut, that's where, you know, Storrs is the seat of the University
right,
of Connecticut, the same
right.
way that Palo Alto is the seat of Stanford or yeah. Ann Arbor is, you know, U Michigan. The difference is in the case of UConn, the basketball teams, I think, helped to diversify the entire community.
Mm-hmm. That
because
makes sense.
when I was young, I mean, UConn basketball sucked.
Right.
You know, it was terrible. I mean, yeah. it was really where anybody came for an easy win, whether it was St. John's, Georgetown, anybody else who kind of came through. But once they hired Jim Calhoun, that began to change. And then over the years, it became a powerhouse. And then, of course, with the women's team and then also the men's team. And then there was also, I think, a year where they both won the national championship. It's now a destination. So you get a lot more people. And so as a result, it's the little things. I mean, part of it is just technology changes a place. Another thing is like I remember back in the day when I was growing up, you had to literally go get in your car and drive half an hour to Hartford in order to get your hair cut if you were black, or maybe go to Willimantic.
Right.
I mean, I think now it's probably possible as a black person to get your hair cut in Storrs.
In Storrs.
Or close by.
Yeah.
I mean, and I know that seems like people were probably looking, you know, or listening right. like, that what? Sounds crazy, but you know, that's what it was like. That's what it was constantly like for me growing up in a place like that, where it was never a question of not knowing who I was or knowing that I was black. But when you are from grade school, from the very beginning, the only black person in your class, you're constantly reminded, even in the most liberal, benign way possible, that you are different than other people. I mean, of course, it doesn't help having a name like Cheo Hadari, but
mm-hmm.
at the same time, you know, it's the other stuff that I think people rightfully get angry about. I grew up with, like, people touching your hair and you're like, you know, wondering if it gets wet, or people mm-hmm. pouring water on your hair and like being amazed at how the water bounces off your hair in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a lot of those curiosities. And so rather than be angry about a lot of it, I think the thing for me is that I was constantly growing up, you know, in a weird way, understanding both sides. And what I mean by that is that on one hand, there was always this curiosity about what it is to be black. And then at the same time, I had my own curiosity because I was constantly in those situations where I was around black people. They were looking at me like, you talk funny. Right. You know, and you sound different. Mm-hmm. And so that made me also think, okay, what does it really mean to be Black? And how can I fit between both of these worlds? And that also kind of comes down to my parents and my mother and my father, mm-hmm. you know, and how different their backgrounds were and how I was constantly trying to kind of find a balance between two cultures, two sides. And really it was hip hop music that helped me make sense of all of that.
Right. Well, and you talked about like being like the Black kid in Stranger Things, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you were kind of a geek at that point, right?
I was a card carrying geek. Yeah. And the reason I say that I grew up as the Black kid in Stranger Things is because that was my childhood. That was, you know, riding bikes and going over to people's houses to play Dungeons and Dragons, going to Mansfield Middle School and hanging out with kids that had like multi-sided dice in their pockets. Right. You know,
right.
It's funny because, you know, so some kids growing up, you know, playing CeeLo, that was not my reality. My reality was kids with multicolored dice and talking about hit points and talking about like, you know, I know what a portable hole is, you know, like just kind of just really weird Dungeons and Dragons stuff. And then at the same time, I didn't realize that all my friends in this weird way were preparing me for my future. Which all friends do. So for example, it's like, in order to be cool, hanging around some of the kids I was hanging around, it wasn't enough to read The Hobbit, Fellowship of the Ring, The Two Towers, and Return of the King. You also had to read the Silmarillion. Like you had to, like, Tolkien was almost like its own religion. And then, you know, you started getting into like Larry Niven, or, you know, I remember reading all of the Pierce Anthony's Xanth books. You know, like that was how I was rolling, essentially. You know, it was just like people that were deep into like science fiction and science fiction fantasy. And then in sixth grade, seventh grade was when I first got into comics. I remember there was this kid, Austin Orth, who, what was the trade we made? I had the first three issues of Gru the Wanderer, and he had the first, or, you know, it was a limited series. He had the four Frank Miller, Chris Claremont Wolverine comics, which were kind of like the first Wolverine miniseries. And so, or, you know, limited series. That was my trade. I gave him my first three or four Gru the Wanderers, and he gave me those Wolverines, which I still have. Although that was, as a sixth grade trade, was pretty cheap compared to how much those individual comics actually cost now.
Right.
But
what do you think they're worth?
I mean, you know, it depends. I mean, you can get a mint version of those. It's a couple hundred dollars. It depends.
Okay.
I mean,
okay.
Because of the movies now, without getting too deep into like comic book prices, and we'll begin to sound like stock traders after a while.
Right. Right. All the
different, you know.
Yeah.
But they're worth a decent amount. They're not worth like it's not like Fantastic Four number one or you know, the first Superman or the first Detective Comic Batman or one of those crazy multi-thousand-dollar comics,
yeah,
nothing like that.
Yeah.
But they're incredibly valuable to me because that's when I really fell in love with comics. And that's when I realized that comics were definitely more than Betty and Veronica. Not to denigrate Betty and Veronica, but what I'm saying is like, you just kind of grew up thinking that comics were funny papers. And then when you started reading the things that Chris Claremont, Frank Miller, and, you know, Alan Moore, of course, and a lot of other comic book authors were doing back then, you realized that there was like kind of expansion of a world, and it was much deeper than anybody thought it was. And then a few years later, I also really discovered just how true that was also for hip hop. And it was just kind of all of these swirling entertainments for me were windows into a world that I wasn't a part of. And so I think I held on to all of it a lot more tightly than most people would, particularly in the case of hip hop. And then in that case, I mean, it just pushed me into everything else that I've ever written or that I've ever done, honestly.
Right. We're going to take just a quick break to tell you about a cool new product that Scott and I discovered. And we'll get back to our guest's amazing Only One story in just a minute.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch. And organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Do you like science fiction? I'm Carrie Bechet, and if you loved movies like Arrival or Interstellar, then you're going to want to check out my podcast, Hypothetical. On Hypothetical, we tell speculative sci-fi stories interwoven with real science. New episodes every Tuesday, available wherever you get podcasts.
So then tell me about going now into the writer's room. Was Southland your first feature?
Southland was my first television show.
Oh, television show. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Well, no, but because you know what happens is, you know, just to kind of make a short story shorter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I graduate from Stanford. I start writing for the LA Times. I'm still writing for Vibe and The Source for a bit. And then a lot of us, you know, really found our voices and found our careers at Vibe, whether it was myself, whether it was Sasha Jenkins, whether it was Mimi Valdez, whether it was Rob also wrote some great pieces, you know, for Vibe.
Mm-hmm.
There were probably about, I want to say 15 or 20 of us that we were constantly competing for these cover stories. And that was the whole thing, was you just put all your eggs into trying to get that $5,000 Vibe cover story. But then, because I was one of the only writers, hip-hop journalists in Los Angeles that still kind of had the ear of the East Coast publications, being in LA, all of a sudden people started selling screenplays. And I realized, like, why am I trying to compete for this $5,000 cover story when someone like Ben Ramsey, you know, writes a spec like The Big Hit or some of the other specs that he was writing? And he was making like $500,000. Mm-hmm. You know, for a spec screenplay. And you're like, whoa,
yeah,
this I'm in the wrong game. So for a while, I started trying to basically was writing screenplays. I co-wrote my first screenplay with my uncle, Richard Wesley. Richard Wesley, he wrote Uptown Saturday Night, Let's Do It Again. And, you know, huge influence on my writing and on my life. And honestly, you know, Rich, I owe everything to Rich. But, you know, we wrote the screenplay for Flow that got sold in 1998 and just never got made. My close friend, the late John Singleton, actually attached himself to direct it and set it up New Line. But I mean, it was in line with, like, John had probably 5-10 movies in development at any particular time.
Right, right.
It gets to a point where you're calling yourself a screenwriter.
Mm-hmm.
But you constantly get to the moment at a Hollywood party where when someone says, "Oh, well, have I seen anything you've written?"
Right,
and then you say no, and then they get that blank look
interest,
on their face,
yeah.
and they just move away from you.
Yeah,
you know. And so, was I a writer from the standpoint of like every once in a while writing something that would just give me enough points for my Writers Guild insurance? Yes, but did I write anything that got made? No. That didn't happen until I had the opportunity to write a book about the Notorious B.I.G.
Right.
And then was asked to write the first drafts of that screenplay, where I ended up getting rewritten by Reggie Rock Bythewood. But, you know, we both had enough material to fairly call it a co-written screenplay. Right when I was, you know, of course it gets made, but then things aren't really going well because, you know, you're just trying so hard to get made. And you know, this is after a strike and everything else. It's just like, it got to a point where I was really about to just like, if this thing didn't go, I was going to just quit screenwriting mm-hmm. and either go in, back into journalism full time, maybe be an editor somewhere, or, you know, go back and get an advanced degree or just do something completely different. Mm-hmm. And that was right around the time that Ann Bitterman created Southland. And then after those first five or six episodes, got picked up for a full season, was looking for other writers, was looking for different voices.
We got
connected.
Ann Bitterman, did she also do Ray Donovan?
Yes.
Okay. I thought so. I didn't realize she did Southland. Go ahead. Because I know you're also a writer on Ray Donovan. So
yeah. So Ann creates Southland. And mm-hmm. I was lucky that the stuff that I was writing, whether it was Notorious or also the spec that I'd written for Antoine Fuqua called Greenlight, mm-hmm. it just, I was different than other writers that were being put in front of her. And, you know, she wanted to do an authentic cop show. And I was lucky enough to make it onto the staff. And the staff itself was just really, in retrospect, like, it was a really great staff. Robin Green and Mitch Burgess, who had already won a lot of their Emmys for The Sopranos, were mm-hmm. on that staff. Mm. Diana Sohn was on that staff. It was myself. It was Nathan Jackson, who he was fresh off of Juilliard. And before that was like, Nathan is such a great storyteller. He talks about, like, because he was living in Kansas City and working in a barbecue joint, literally having dogs chase him home because he was in the kitchen. And when he found out that he got in Juilliard, and wrote some really great plays at Juilliard. And then Bam was on the staff. You know, he and I were just basically, you know, the only brothers in this predominantly white room. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't just the fact that we were the only two black people in that room, but it's just the fact that everybody there had all this extensive experience. Right. David Graziano, who his most recent show that he's running now is Coyote, I think, on CBS All Access. He was in that room. And that's the thing. You're sitting there and you're asking yourself, or at least I was asking myself, like, why am I here? Like, I'm looking, John Wells is, you know, on one end of the table and Chris Trulax on the other end of the table. You know, John, of course, had done ER and all these other legendary shows, West Wing. And you're just looking at all this television experience and these Emmys and you're like, what am I doing here? And then I realized very quickly, like, okay, I'm the only person in this room that has been in Compton with the game with an AK-47 on the ottoman while a police helicopter is going, you know, right. overhead.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, so it's like, this is a cop show. They want to tell write a show about the real Los Angeles, but I'm the only person that's kind of been, you know, besides the police ride-alongs that we've been doing for the show. I've also been in the cars when they've been stopped. I've also been in places, mm-hmm. you know, where you're essentially under police surveillance.
Right.
You know, I understand what's happening, like, just because of all the everyone that I've interviewed, just in terms of hardcore hip hop in Los Angeles, like, you know, the mentality and, you know, not just the what, but the why mm-hmm. and the how. Mm-hmm. And then I realized, okay, so again, like, how do you write about this authentically without it being minstrelsy, if you want to call it that,
right.
or I don't know if minstrelry, if whatever the term is. Mm-hmm. And again, you start applying some of those same lessons that you learned from hip hop journalism now dramatically,
right.
you know, not just in terms of the dialogue, but just in terms of the scenarios. Okay. So how can you write about what's happening in a way that it makes sense to people that are going through it, but then you're also capturing, you know, the police perspective. Even now, it's a tricky road to navigate, but I think that Southland, compared to other cop shows, I mean, really compared only to The Wire, I think is really the only show that in some ways, you know, of course, Homicide as well, but really The Wire, definitely. I think The Wire and Southland are really the only two shows that really get it right.
Wow. I'm so glad you talked about that, because that's exactly what your thesis is, that you're the only person translating. And then can you just talk about your only one statement? Because you were talking about it before we started recording, and I just thought you hit it so well when you were explaining why, first of all, that you weren't just translating Black culture for white people. You were doing it in a way that won't be, what did you say?
Well, no, the thing is that the beauty of hip hop, the beauty of film is that both mediums allow you to define your reality. And they allow you to define your reality on your own terms. And when writing about both and then eventually making both, you have this thing where you're trying to capture a reality, but then at the same time, not dilute it, not water it down, not, you know, make it a cliche or offend the history and the culture where it comes from is the way that I would say it. And so even though on the surface saying that you're translating Black culture for white people, which is constantly what happens as a Black screenwriter, particularly when you're writing about African-American subjects for predominantly white producers and, of course, white-run studios, mm-hmm. is that, yeah, there is, you could very easily find yourself doing what every person's nightmare is, which is just like writing something that you have no control over and that just ends up being like the worst, most cliche, stereotypical thing out there. Mm-hmm. But what you hope to do is you hope to offer a window into an experience and a people as best you can capture something that everybody can relate to and understand. So for example, like when I talk about a movie that I love, that's really a big influence on me, like Trainspotting, mm-hmm. that was directed by Danny Boyle.
Right.
I don't know anything about Scotland or heroin, but when I watch that movie, it drops me into this world that with no explanation. And you have to just kind of watch and figure it out. And it's explaining things, but then at the same time, it's doing it in a way that people from Glasgow that have seen that movie, mm-hmm. or and even some people that have gone through the whole, you know, experience of that drug and getting off that drug, which is largely what that movie is about,
right.
will often say that that movie was authentic, you know, to mm-hmm. to that experience.
Right.
And so, and people that love movies just love that movie.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what you hope to do with anything that you write. And so that's what I mean by that. So it's like, that was one of the things with Luke Cage was I always called Luke Cage inclusively Black rather than exclusively Black. What I mean by that is that like, it's just like dropping people into the world and not explaining things. And, you know, it was funny because when the show first dropped, I remember the Twitter reaction was huge. I was just kind of getting into Twitter, just kind of discovering really the influence and the power of Black Twitter, so to speak. But as much as people loved the show, it was fascinating that there were also like Marvel fans that when they first saw the show, they were like, is this show for me? Because I haven't seen a white person in 20 minutes.
Right.
And it wasn't even like it was a conscious effort to do that.
Right.
You know, but and at Marvel, I was surrounded by nothing but white people mm-hmm. and they didn't even notice.
Right.
Or even think of anything of it. It's yeah. just like, you just, you know, the whole thing with Luke Cage is okay. We're going to drop you into an authentic barbershop experience.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the same time, go from there to Cottonmouth Club and, you know, kind of introducing this entire world. We had a moment with Scarf, who was the only white character in the club, but we took him out of that scene. So I guess that's why it took 20 minutes as opposed to 12 or 15 minutes to get a white person on the screen.
Right.
But you know, that's the thing. And my thing about it was like, I really wanted Luke Cage to be somebody that was Black and didn't happen to be Black, you know, because there are all these different ways I could have done Luke Cage. I could have done the version of Luke Cage where it's just like, you know, he just happens to be Black, where mm-hmm. it's just like, it's the culture isn't really a big deal. You know, the music isn't really there. And he's just kind of a fugitive and he just wears bummy clothes and he's just, you know,
right.
hiding out. And, you know, we don't get into anything else that's happening. You know, there's another version where I could have just done like this kind of 70s throwback Sweet Christmas version of the show.
Right.
But instead, what I wanted to do was, I wanted to explore different sides of what it means to be a Black man. And the thing about the show that's just funny to me, it makes me realize how old I am, is that I think it really depends on your age, how you like the show. I always find that people that are younger, like tend to find the show slow or they always call it corny, you know, which I'm okay with because hell, I'm almost 50. I am corny. So I can live with that,
hey,
with
now.
That criticism of it.
Don't put an age on corny.
But what happens is that I always find that younger fans, you know, sometimes tend to like Black Lightning more than Luke Cage. Mm. And they'll say, well, Luke Cage is preachy, or, you know, there's this off theme, you know, it's fake, where they say Luke Cage tells people to pull their pants up, which is not the case. But, you know, and I think, and then also it's interesting because it's the first Marvel property to ever use the N-word. And I think the thing about that, because I remember when they first asked me about it, like why I wanted to use it, I said, honestly, Jeff, it's more offensive to not be told that I can't use the word than actually using the word.
Yes.
And so the thing for me about using the word was that I wanted to show, just as it is in the Black community, everybody has a different experience and feeling about that word. Mm-hmm. And so in the first two episodes of Luke Cage, when we're making a point of it, you kind of hear all those different perspectives.
Right.
And that also comes from my hip hop perspective, because the era of hip hop that I come from, which is really like, you know, the late 80s, early 90s, everybody that used that word usually had a song talking about why they used that word, as opposed to this current generation where it's just a word,
right?
You know? And so it's just interesting because it's like when people would call like Luke Cage preacher, they say, well, Luke's conservative. I said, look, I mean, the brother's more Big Daddy Kane than Herman Cain, you know, it's you know, because that's kind of what the perspective was.
Right.
So what I find is that older fans, like people, you know, in their 30s and up, really like Luke Cage. Mm-hmm. People that are kind of younger will say things. Everybody's still pissed that I killed off Cottonmouth.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to talk to you about that.
But that was kind of something that was going to happen, you know, from the
anyway,
beginning.
Yeah. I want to be mindful of time here. And first of all, Luke Cage crashed Netflix, which was never done before, right? When it came out. Tell me just a little bit about that.
Well, what happened was, you know, the show drops on September 30th, 2016. And then the next day on Saturday, the network crashed. Netflix went offline for like a couple of hours at least. They say that it was because of the worldwide popularity of Luke Cage, and there was a glitch in the servers, and they had to catch up with it. And it's the only show to do that before or since. The reason I ascribe that to is that everybody around the world all at once, particularly people that were interested in the music and everything else, all wanted to watch the show at the same time.
Right.
And that was kind of the cross appeal of it.
Yes.
And I found out internally from Netflix that it was just a small glitch, but the reason they couldn't get to it was because of the overwhelming traffic.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, so sometimes as a defense, they'll say, well, the show didn't really crash Netflix. But what I say is that if there was less traffic, y'all could have fixed the problem. So
right.
Yeah. You know,
it's so awesome.
But that was the thing, was that the fact that happened, I think, and Ryan Coogler and I talked about this, it's what gave him confidence that he could do an equally unapologetically Black version of Black Panther.
Yeah.
And do it in such a way that the entire world not only was ready for it, but would be, you know, awaiting it. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing, was that they were able to translate that success and do it on an entirely much bigger, newer level. Because that's the one thing that, you know, the kind of camaraderie of Marvel is that every person that makes an innovation makes it easier for the next person to do the same thing. Mm. So, for example, with what they did with Guardians of the Galaxy, the fact that it was using like 70s rock.
Right.
You know, and instead of what the Spider-Man movie, even though Marvel at the time didn't do the Spider-Man movies, but, you know, all the Spider-Man movies at the time always had some like bad alt rock or new rock or some just bullshit music, as opposed to, you know, doing something that was kind of retro but cool. And then when there was success with the Guardians of the Galaxy soundtracks,
I still, you know, love that soundtrack.
That really kind of gave any creators like the license. That gave me the license to say, okay, Guardians of the Galaxy did so well. Mm-hmm. I want to do something different musically with Luke Cage,
right?
Where I want to use the blues and soul and hip hop and, you know, but not just any hip hop, but like very specific Wu-Tang, mm-hmm. you know, 90s, mm-hmm. you know, Carhartt, you know, Timbaland hip hop.
Yeah.
And embrace that. And then when it worked, that also helped Ryan from saying, when he had those arguments with like, I'm going to open a movie with Too Short.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because it's Oakland. You know, and he's from and he's from the Bay Area.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, and no one says a peep, you know, because they couldn't make the argument that it wouldn't work.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And so all of us, because of all the things with Black Panther in so many ways being its you know, most successful movie, not only staying in that sandbox will Ryan be able to break more barriers at the same time, anybody coming after Ryan directing movies will be also be able to break other rules, because the success of that franchise and of Luke Cage and of everything else just includes, it really just says that around the world, people just want cool shit. They don't really care about labels. They don't care about what it is. It's urging people to try new things and that there's somebody that wants to see it.
Absolutely. Which now brings me, for these last couple minutes, I want you to tell me about your Amazon deal, about Fighting 99th Entertainment.
Working on different things and just trying to get a show on the air. And, you know, Amazon has been incredibly generous with their time and their money and trying to find that thing. And it's a different space for me because I've never really had the encouragement to just like do your thing and just figure out what that is. And then like, let's make it, let's go for it.
Right.
And so that's really what it is. And then at the same time, while doing that, I've also, because that's an exclusive television deal, so I've been working within that framework for TV, I've also still been doing film stuff, writing and rewriting different movies. And it's been an incredible year and a half. I mean, honestly, really just thinking about this last year and all the things that have happened in terms of COVID and in terms of the shutdowns and everything else. Mm-hmm. And George Floyd and the election, and thank God, you know, Biden won.
Right.
All that stuff. Just how much things have changed in the space of a year. Mm-hmm. But then at the same time, while all these things are happening, living in Seattle and like literally watching protests, thousands of people walk by my window and then getting a call like, where's the script?
Right.
You know, it's just... It's been this weird thing of just kind of being trapped and just like writing all the time and trying to like, you know, relearn how to sleep, how to take better care of myself and work out and still produce writing wise. And I'm lucky enough to be working, you know, because with so many people being unable to work, the last thing I'm going to do is complain about what I'm doing, but still kind of find that emotional space to mourn and to find resolve to deal with what's happening in the world. That's the one thing that happens with Hollywood, is that ultimately, I don't care how much lip service they give to these causes and everything else. They don't give a fuck. They want what they want. They want their scripts.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you just have to deal with that. You have to deal with everything else that's happening and still make sure that you're writing.
Yep.
And that's what I do, you know, is I still in my little corner.
Yes.
Translate Black culture for white folks. And then at the same time, you know, and trying to create a bigger, more inclusive Hollywood for myself and for, you know, my people.
Yeah. We're going to wrap up now, but I'm just thinking, Cheo, I'm so glad we did this. I learned so much more about you. Everything that you talked about, you know, the way you grew up, who you grew up with, what you threw yourself into, what came out of it, all each thing prepared you for the next thing, you know, in a way that you probably couldn't have seen then. Is each time, you know, being that geek, that, you know, Lord of the Rings comic book geek prepared you, you know, for Luke Cage and for that whole world. And, you know, even before that. And then your love for hip hop prepared you for that intersection. And it's just so cool that you continue to go where your experience brought you and then opened another door when you got there. And it's also cool that people welcomed you into those spaces because they saw that you carried something, you brought with you something that was really unique. I love your writing. I love everything you've written. I'm going to have to watch Southland because I haven't seen it. We should watch that next time.
I've already actually watched some of it. I had no idea that Cheo was a writer.
Really?
No.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. It's actually HBO Max now.
Okay. Oh, that's easy.
Has Southland without too much of a plug. But
yes. we'll watch it there. But, you know, I feel so lucky to know you and fortunate to know you. And I'm so glad that you and I have stayed in each other's lives for all these years.
And vice versa, because, you know, as much as knowing you for all these years and as much as I thought I knew about you, like reading all those different Huffington Post
pieces
were just, as I told you, that, like, you know, they're absolutely amazing. Oh. And it's a different perspective and narrative than anybody's heard. And so, you know, I'm gonna continue to urge you at some point to you know, make a film or a TV show based on some of those experiences. And don't be surprised if I knock on your door.
You have encouraged me so much in that area, and I really want to thank you for that, because there are times where I might have thought about going in a different direction, but you just came in and said, no, this is great. Mm-hmm. This is what you should be doing.
I remember that day.
Yeah. And I was like, okay, all right, this is it.
That was the first time I had heard your name.
Yeah. Uh-huh. There you go. Tao, where can people find you?
Well, I'm trying to hide out. So,
we'll disclose that later.
No, I mean, you know, so I guess people can follow me on Twitter. You know, Cheo, Cheo underscore Coker, Coker is my Twitter handle, or at, you know, at Cheo underscore Coker.
You're also on Instagram.
Yeah, I'm also on Instagram. Mm-hmm. But I mean, but that's the thing for me, is just that, like, I just do what I do.
Right.
And I try not to think about the fact that I got thousands of people that, like, you know, care about what I do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so that's always the weirdest thing. I mean, because I think everyone's so happy in this Instagram, Twitter age. So you can follow me here and you can do this and I do
right,
that. And
right.
Like, half the time I'm just talking shit. I'm just like, this is what I think at this one moment. And that's it. You know,
right.
And it's just like, it's just me. Like, it's funny because, like, I'll write sometimes these Twitter things and then, like, people will actually write articles about them. And half the time I'm just geeking out. Like, you know, and it's just, that's the only thing that kind of, doesn't give me pause. I just think about it, like, you know, my opinion shouldn't matter more than anybody else's because of the fact that I'm lucky enough to, you know, work in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
If anything, I'm just hoping that it empowers and excites people enough to say that they can do it too.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. Well, I enjoy your
post. Ultimately, it's just, honestly, it's just like, I always get a lot of questions like, how do you become a writer? How do you do this? How do you do that? And I'm going to start writing more about how to do these things. But at the same time, you know, it's just, sometimes you just have a passion and you just have to let it out. And then it's just about just putting one word after the other. And I know it sounds mystical or I'm dumbing it down, but like, it's just as simple as that. But then at the same time, you know, that's really what's incredible about it is, is you think, okay, I wrote this and people care about it.
Mm-hmm.
You just feel lucky in that and just so appreciative.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Well, I appreciate you, Cheo. Thank you so much.
No, thank you. And thank you for asking me to do this and everything else. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to The Only One in the Room. Please join us each Tuesday and Sunday for an incredible brand new Only One interview. And every Friday for On My Nightstand, where I'll be reading something that I love. If you have an Only One story you'd like to share or a piece of writing you'd like to submit, please send it to theonlyonepod@gmail.com. From all of us at The Only One in the Room, we wish you dopeness, health, and prosperity.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Join co-hosts Will and Brian as they break down the lore of a rich multiverse 50 years in the making in a lighthearted and beginner-friendly way. They cover everything from character creation options to tips for dungeon masters. There's something for everyone, no matter how long you've been playing TTRPGs. Get inspired while learning all about the unique planes of existence. Get the in-depth knowledge you need to help your combat encounters feel impactful, or learn about the origins and pantheons of every race and class the game offers. No stone is left unturned as every edition of the game is explored and explained in a way that benefits players of all different levels of experience. You can expand your TTRPG horizons in a way that's as entertaining as it is educational just by listening. All you have to do is go to your favorite podcast app or YouTube and search for The Dungeon Cast.